We all ready to go? When we left off, we were in the middle of the management advisory team recommendations. Is there any additional comments or concerns we want to voice on that recommendation? I guess the substance of that one was to assign a specific entity to be kind of the operational director of the group and to exclude the landowners from direct membership on the team. And I think that's the substance, and some language changes there to allow for how the input to the management advisory team is given to the holder or the landowner. So,
Bart, there was some Rebecca. Talk about the landowners being, well, sometimes it was couched as non-voting members of the team, and at some points they were called advisors, but we probably need to tie up that relationship somehow.
Okay.
Yep. Rebecca?
I have a question for the staff and consultants. On the top of 87, page 87, it talks about established right of holder to remove pre-qualified program. And this is with regard to certification programs. Can you speak to that section?
Sure. And there are really two recommendations, kind of the flip side of maybe the same coin. The way the easement is written now, there are three certification programs that we use the term are pre-qualified. FSC, SFI, and American Tree Farm. With two of those programs, we're not recommending any changes to the pre-qualification, except for that a mechanism be in place, put in place in the easement, that they not be pre-qualified in perpetuity. You know, for instance, you have an SFI program that, you know, as my understanding, didn't exist 20 years ago. And there is, the way we read the language of the easement, I believe the way Jerry reads it, he and I have discussed this, is that there's no mechanism in the easement that if either FSC or SFI take a turn for the worst or don't, you know, times change. Again, in perpetuity is a really long time. There's no ability with an appropriate process, and you don't want a process where the easement holder can just wake up on the wrong side of bed and say, I don't like SFI anymore. There would have to be a process and some give and take, and we can work out the language of that. But you don't want an in perpetuity easement that kind of pre-qualifies in memoriam for all time. So that's the first part. The second part is there is not only, Commissioner Kurtz, no record evidence that the American Tree Farm System certification program is appropriate for large landscape scale easement certification, but the only record evidence on this is that it's not. Now, I think there also is record evidence that for lots of 5 or 10,000 acres, it seems perfectly fine. And so to the extent that you chose not to eliminate it but wanted to make it a lot smaller as to where it could be used, that would capture the same intent as eliminating it. However, I want to note that eliminating something from pre-qualification as a certifying program doesn't mean that there's a specific provision in there at the end of these pre-qualifications that give the holder the right to bring in new programs or existing programs if they meet the same standards. So, and we're not recommending any change to that language. So That's the basis for all of that.
So the alternative, though, is the LMF model, which allows the holder to approve an independent third-party certification. Is there one seems to say you can eliminate, one says you can add, but is there a way to have them, is implicit in that that they can do both?
Well, the LMF model is really a different approach. The LMF model leaves it to the holder to decide if they want to certify, and if so, who should be the certifying party. And that the LMF model also requires that that decision be rethought approximately every 3 years or be revisited every 3 years. And we're not proposing here, we wanted to apprise you of that alternative, but we're not proposing moving away from the model that Plum Creek is proposing here, which is that you have certain pre-certified programs as long as there's an opportunity, which I think gives is part of what Plum Creek is proposing is important, I would guess, to them in the certification process. But we are proposing a process where that pre-qualification can be revisited. Under the LMF model, the easement does not specify a certification. It's left up to the holder to decide, and certification really there fills the function of eliminating certain monitoring duties of the holder. It's holder-initiated in those situations. But if you are uncomfortable with any pre-certification program, that would be the model that LMF has landed on. The model LURC easement terms do not really get into this issue. In fact, they don't get into this issue.
I guess the concern I have with this, with the first paragraph, and I may still be confused on this, is the right of the holder to remove a pre-qualified program. Let's say over time both SFI and FSC fail to carry out the responsibilities of, or in your words, sort of just fail. What are we left with?
No, I think the easement. I understand. I think the easement addresses that. First of all, the easement doesn't require a landowner to have certification. Okay, so that's point number one. So at worst, you're left. At worst, or whatever you're left with is maybe there's no certifying agents at all. You know, certification for whatever reason in 100 years is passé or not economic or whatever. So the easement is. The easement. No certification is required. The holder does monitoring. There's no protections given to the landowner by certain certification findings. It's just not done. That can happen today. Under this easement, even if there's only one landowner, Plum Creek can decide that it doesn't want to certify and that it's a dialogue exclusively between it and the holder. Secondly, what I think would happen is after, you know, a full and fair process of deciding that FSC and SFI don't work, if a landowner aren't working or aren't adequate, if a landowner still wanted certification, I assume there would be another certifying entity or an amendment that had emerged, and that would be worked into an amended management plan, and so it would come forth. So I don't think you have a system that falls apart.
Just a thought. Does the commission have any role in any of this? I mean, in any kind of decisions that are made and any changes over time that occur within these
not
easements?
The commission is given certain roles in the easement. The commission has to approve a new holder if there is an assignment to a different holder. I'll have to go back. I believe the commission has to approve amendments to the easement itself, what we were talking about earlier, and we'll get to. The issue of certification is not one that I believe the commission is in any way involved in under what's written now. This is not, as written now, a role that the commission is involved in.
And just to elaborate on that a little bit, the staff is not recommending that the commission have a role in that process because these recommendations, as you will see, sort of decouple the certification process from the management advisory team role. And that is the function that we see as important to the wildlife mitigation component. And to the extent that the landowner wishes to use a certification program as evidence to the management advisory team that it is fulfilling certain functions, or to the holder, excuse me, that it is fulfilling its wildlife management obligations, we see that as a perfectly appropriate approach. But we're really decoupling those two.
Yeah, I would just say, Commissioner Hilton, that the recommendations on page 87 in terms of the certifying program itself are really quite narrow. It's just allow for change and either eliminate, or if you want to, very much limit, based on record evidence, where the American Tree Farm certification program can be used. Start from the get-go. There aren't those limitations that are proposed on either FSC or SFI.
Anything else?
I'd just like to say I'm not all that concerned about the certification one way or the other. I think it was advanced by the applicant, and I think that's laudable. But for reasons that I've mentioned before, I think certification programs, I don't think in terms of the public benefits, assuring the public benefits here, that the certification program in and of itself is going to carry the water. I think that many of these, and again, I'm not directing this at Plum Creek or the easement holders or the certification mechanisms. I mean, this is across the board, as I mentioned, academic programs. I mean, we certify all kinds of things as being meeting certain standards, and quite frankly, much of that is for marketing reasons rather than operating standards reasons. Not to say that there isn't some impact on that, but so I'm willing to place my faith, if you will, in the management team as opposed to spending a tremendous amount of time on certification.
The real thing is the holder will play the key role. And if we go into the next piece here, which is the impact of the third-party certification, that's where the nuts and bolts of it are in terms of who really isn't going to have the responsibility to make sure the easement is terms are enforced. Certification, obviously is an important piece of that. And as Ron has pointed out, it serves an important role for the holder in providing a lot of information about what's happening. And documents the process. A lot of these certification systems are as much about doing the paperwork right as they are about what actually happens. Based on my experience, anyway, there's lots and lots of paperwork involved in them.
Right, and it is about marketing. Like, I mean, it's required to raise the value of your product, I think, in the forest industry to be certified. And it's not cheap. Right. Certification is not cheap, and it brings another entity in because quite a few of the certifications are held by another party. Anyway, I think it's a good thing.
It's a huge obligation on the owner, and it's very expensive.
If I'm following this correctly, does this mean that certification in and of itself has no value to the easement and what we are doing here?
No. Chair Harvey suggested this is really the page 88. What I understood Chair Harvey saying is, okay, if you're in agreement, we've dealt with the issues of who's allowed to do the certifying, and now we're into the issue of what does it all mean. Here we are proposing what I believe to be recommending to you a significant language change. It's also a language change, I would note, that has been endorsed in their briefs by the Forest Society of Maine and TNC. Unlike in other easements of which we're aware, there's a provision here that gives certification. It really very presumptively means, and presumptively may even be mild, given the language that I'll read to you, presumptively means that once this certification is, once a piece of land is certified, even with all kinds of caveats, once that good housekeeping seal is stamped down, the holder has very little opportunity under the language here to say, excuse me, but we disagree in this particular area. And that's the language we cited here, in which that presumption, well, so long as grantor maintains a third-party certification that the protected properties are being managed in accordance with qualifying forestry certification programs, then there shall be a rebuttable presumption that grantor is in full compliance with said forestry principles and the management plan. That presumption shall be overcome only in the event that evidence shows that the third-party certification was based on a material mistake of fact or a material misapplication of the standards of the qualifying forestry certification program. And then it goes on to say, in order to rebut that presumption, holder shall first seek to resolve any compliance with the grantor, which we're not recommending be changed. And then they have to go through the appeals process. So you have a situation, as we said here, going to, okay, you've got the certifying party, what's the impact, where you could have a certification that grants certification but finds problems and issues with wildlife management or with how special management areas were cut. And unless it meets this very high standard, in my view, and again, I invite Jerry to comment, that's quite unique in what we've seen in other easements.
Okay, but I understand that. I guess what I thought I heard you say was, or someone say here, that the certification, it could be a situation where there is, that we're not requiring certification.
Right, and in which case that language wouldn't apply.
So that was, there could be, what you're proposing is that it would be possible not to have any certification.
That's in the easement right now. If there's no certification, there's no rebuttable presumption is what certification means, and the holder then sends a letter to Plum Creek or whomever the landowner is saying, based on our annual monitoring, we find the following problems and we'd like to meet to discuss with you, and there's no intervening party of the certifying and no weight given to it because it doesn't exist. So it can go down two different tracks.
Jerry, do you?
Well, I agree with what Ron has said, again, because we've been working on this together. To get at Commissioner Hilton's question, the point is that there are great benefits to the landowner going through the certification process, so great that they really have the effect of severely limiting the holder's option in the face of certification if the holder believes there are underlying problems despite the certification. So that's what the recommendation is designed to address.
Any other comments on that issue?
Well, I just would note that there is evidence in the record, there's testimony in the record to the effect that while Plum Creek was granted certification and retained certification, it was also subject to some of the largest fines in the state of Maine for cutting in deer yards. So if certification were dispositive, and not presumptive, then that wildlife, the wildlife values associated with the easement would be jeopardized. So, I mean, it seems to me that, yeah, there ought to be presumption associated with certification. I think it's important, but it shouldn't be dispositive in terms of whether or not the values of the easement are being complied with.
Well, I think that's what the recommended language proposes address that issue, such that
I agree
the holder becomes the clearly in charge. I guess that's what it amounts to.
But I guess I was responding to Gwen's.
Right. Because
that's the way I would do it.
Yeah.
And certification then becomes evidence of compliance.
Right. Yeah. Evidence.
Yeah, right. But that's, if we agree with the staff, then that's what they're recommending then.
I agree with the staff recommendation.
Subject to comment.
Subject to comment.
And I don't expect we'll get much on this issue, but we'll give it out anyway. Anything else on the third-party certification process? If not, I'm going to move on to the management plan, which another important part of this process. I would think, particularly in the absence of any certification process, the management plan takes on added significance, if that were to be the case. I don't think that's what's going to happen here, but you want to give us any background on this, Ron, or?
Just briefly, I think it's pretty much captured here. There are really 2 points. The middle paragraph on the recommendation, remove language and management team advisory structure and role, place that in the easement. That's just really a legal housekeeping thing to make sure that that role is clear in the easement and it doesn't depend on a particular management plan. As written, the multi-resource management plan first contained inconsistencies with the easement, and you didn't have to go any further than the page beyond the cover sheet to see those inconsistencies, where it talked about intents and purposes of the plan that of the management plan that were either inconsistent with or not completely encompassing of the purposes in the easement. In fairness, I suspect that this language was written and there's suggestions in it that it references the Forest Legacy Funding Program and it was probably written for a different purpose or whatever. But they're inconsistencies. And so there's another example of an inconsistency is at the end of the management advisory plan, the management advisory plan can be amended between the holder and the landowner. Under the easement in Section 5D Romanet 1, the management plan can only be amended with the consent as well as the third-party holder. So there is a fair amount of housekeeping. That's number one, and that goes to that. There are provisions in the management plan that lift up whole cloth language in the easement and apply it to the management plan and drop it in the management plan, but it's not the whole story. So there are places in there where parts are put in without any clear reason as opposed to the whole. I think these are very easy, I want to say, to clean up. There's language in here that can be read as the holder endorsing Plum Creek's forest practices and endorsing SFI, that it's not clear why you would want it, and certainly our recommendation is that you don't want it in the management plan. Our view of the management plan is it sets out, the management plan should have a single purpose, which is to set out, in their words, the programs and practices by which this land will be managed, that will then be the guide that the auditor will use, the holder will use, that Plum Creek will use. And there's a lot of legal surplusage right now in this management plan that can be eliminated. So that's really recommendation number one. I suspect that that will be easy. The third recommendation, there is a fair amount of testimony, including quite specific testimony from Inland Fisheries and Wildlife in their November 20th comments, significant detailed testimony from Maine Audubon Society and NRCM's Forester and Rob Ryan, who also is involved in certification, that the programs and practices listed are either incomplete, that it's a subset of the whole, and I think that would be a fair characterization of part of IFNW's November 20th testimony, that they're incomplete, they don't cover everything that they should, or the language is so vague that, as we said here, that it doesn't contain standards of conduct that can be measured and enforced. And we are not suggesting here that this language be so detailed and prescriptive that evolving knowledge that comes from MAT or comes from Plum Creek or whatever landowner lock them into 2008 as opposed to 2028 and 2048, et cetera, et cetera. But the comments that we've received from IFNW particularly, but other parties, is that there should be another look at some of this language to make sure that the programs and practices necessary to assure sufficient mitigation for wildlife are achieved. So that's what that recommendation is about. It's really to allow, it's a directive from you to staff consultants in the Attorney General's office to go back and see if there are any changes that need to be made, both for completeness and particularly to ensure that the language contains, quote, standards of conduct and that can be measured and enforced. And it may end up that we come back to you and say, based on a further review, we respectfully disagree with IFNW and other parties, and it is just right on the money down to the period.
Well, I agree, Ron, with you in respect to being overly prescriptive, because given the dynamic nature of what you're dealing with, I think we've got to be awful careful about tying our hands, because we'll end up with a bad result for sure. So
then, just to complete that, on the bottom of page 89, paragraph 6, there are attached to the management plan and apparently incorporated therein, as we say, these documents, two documents, one titled Plum Creek, Maine and New Hampshire Environmental Action Plan, and a second being the Maine Forest Products Council Conservation Strategy for the Canada Lynx in Maine. Jerry's in my legal judgment. Again, I'll take the lead, and he can pull my leash. Is that, at best, the role of these documents and the many, many statements made therein, the role that these documents play legally in the management plan is unclear, and that at worst, these two documents contain additional programs and practices. And so our recommendation is eliminate the document, and the documents contain many, many other things. They contain a description of where Plum Creek operates and where their headquarters in Maine is and, you know, all those kinds of things. So what staff's recommending, I believe is Jerry's recommendation, is that these documents be eliminated. You have a management plan, and that whatever appropriate standards need to be pulled in from them are pulled in as standards, as programs and practices, and that they don't kind of hang there in this unclear status at best.
I think these are wise recommendations. I agree.
I guess I agree as well. I do have, but I do have a question on page 90. In the recommendations for the baseline documentation, the use of the terms rare, exemplary, unique ecological characteristics as being the areas that are to be documented and mapped. Those are very specific, aren't they? I mean, in our main natural resource laws, I mean, they're referring to things very specifically identified. Is that correct? And I guess what I'm wondering is whether is that everything that we want to be in that baseline documentation?
These terms were pulled from either language in the easement or from comments of IFNW or Maine Natural Areas Program. I will confess that in the as part of this process, I did review MNAP's governing statute. It was a while ago. I have not gone back and kind of cross-correlated these terms to that particular language, and I have done none of that review for IFNW statutory. So if I can get a better sense of what kind of directive you want to give to us, I think Jerry, I'm volunteering Jerry with no authority to do so, would then go back and do his usually thorough and copious review of those terms to see either whether they're too inclusive or not inclusive enough, given where you want to go with this, Commissioner.
Okay. I think being clear on what we're asking to be included in the baseline documentation is important, what's included in those things. And I guess that's just something that I'd like clarification on at some point.
Got it. Is everybody clear on page 90 on what we are and are not saying on the public access provision? I'm not trying to get discussion going, but I just want to make sure that if there's a desire to understand that we satisfy that.
Are you suggesting, as we normally do, that the state law governing recreation on private lands by the public is sufficient?
Well, let me first suggest, and then I want to quickly on this one, because I feel Jerry's stare even without looking at him, and turn it over to him. Let me be specific as to what we're suggesting be removed, if I can quickly find it, which is what I think the Attorney General's office believes is an overly broad provision. That says as follows. This is in the end of paragraph 7, public access easement, and that's what this recommendation seeks to remove. Any use of the protected property by the public is at the public's sole risk and liability, and any use of the protected property shall be deemed a waiver of any and all liability of the grantor, its successors, and assigns for injury, loss, or damage occurring from such use. Jerry, you want to
Sure. It's fine. In one place in the easement, the document invokes the current landowner liability law and any amendments thereto as applying, which is fine. What is not fine is for the easement to purport to fix or freeze into place in perpetuity certain provisions governing liability. That is the equivalent of making law in the easement, which we have no authority to do. So whatever changes the legislature may see fit to make governing liability on this land or any other land is uniquely within their ability to do. We have no authority to freeze into place in this easement provisions governing that. So that's, in, I hope, a simplified way, the principle that we're trying to respect here.
So are you saying that you would hang your hat on the public liability law as amended from time to time?
That's fine. Whatever law is in place governs, but we can't make up our own law and freeze it into place through the easement.
Everybody comfortable or clear with that? I guess we don't have, according to Jerry, we don't have any choice, so. I like it. I suspect there will be some arguments with you on that issue.
I know there to be some differences of opinion on this, and we may get some comments, which we'll, you know, take into account.
Okay.
But the principle that I tried to describe is something that I feel pretty strongly about, and there may be some ways to work around the edges of it. But freezing into place liability provisions in the easement, I think, is something that is problematic for a number of reasons.
In any event, landowners in the state of Maine do have some liability protection. It may not be as absolute or complete as the landowner's lawyer would like it, but it is there.
But it's actually known to be some of the best in the country.
It's what, Steve?
It's known to be some of the best liability protection in the country.
I'm not aware of that, but that's good if it is, I guess.
And the only reason I raised this is I wanted to make clear that by eliminating what I believe, and I believe Jerry believes, is a overreaching provision of liability does not mean that we're suggesting that Plum Creek be denied the rights that are provided now, just like any other landowner that provides public access has those rights.
All right. Enforcement, this has to do with the ability of the holder to enforce terms of the easement. Gets back to the certification process, I suppose, and other things. And again, we're proposing here a number of fairly, I would take it, depending on your point of view, fairly significant language changes to the easement to affect how that enforcement activity might take place. So, do you have any questions? Who spoke? I'm sorry, I missed. Oh, Ron, sorry.
Well, if there are no questions, I'm happy to let it go.
Well, I'll ask the question for the sake of hearing from you, but I don't know how you can eliminate the ability to hold of the holder to gain remedy.
Well, this provision, to be clear, and Jerry may want to jump in quickly here, did not eliminate the ability of the holder to have a remedy. It eliminated the ability of the holder to obtain monetary penalties in appropriate situations. So, or it could be, I think a fair reading would be that. So to the extent that there was conduct that, you know, could in a tortious situation constitute gross negligence and should be penalized, there was not, and disincentivized, so to speak, there was not that ability. That was not a provision that I'm aware of. There was significant testimony that that was a provision that was inconsistent with your model easement terms. It's a provision that I'm not aware of is in the LMF model easement as well. Jerry, you may want to jump in on that.
All these recommendations on enforcement are designed to make sure that, you know, you can have the most beautiful easement in the world, but if it's not enforceable in a meaningful and practical way, it doesn't do any good. So Ron and I have taken a hard look at this. It's an area that's uniquely important to me, given my position in my office. And the changes we're recommending are simply designed to make sure the holder, whoever it is fully capable of enforcing the terms.
Okay, I don't see any other questions or concerns being raised. I assume we will receive comments concerning this. The modification of the easement boundaries.
The issue here, just because I'm going to offer something here, because it's related to, or it may be thought of as a subset of the discussion that you were having earlier on amendments. One type of amendment that may be appropriate or not is the modification of easement boundaries. That is different than an amendment that might allow geothermal use. What staff is recommending here, staff and consultants are recommending, is to redraft to eliminate the possibility of major land swaps that undermine this commission's intent for certain east lands. I think it's perfectly appropriate to allow boundary modifications for ease of boundary identification or other narrow administrative purposes. But the way this is written now, swaps are allowed. But I do want to note the last sentence, holder and approval by LURC is required here. For the purpose of protecting important conservation values. So the possibility legally that is allowed with this language is that a commission 20 years from now decides that it has certain conservation lands in mind that are different, that Plum Creek or subsequent landowner owns, that are different from what you had in mind, and it approves that. That may or may not be the kind of latitude that this commission wants to give, but I'm just flagging that issue.
Ron, does in your recommendation, you don't have is what you said about it requiring joint approval apply to the recommendation that you have? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that applies. I don't think the issue is LURC doesn't have any control if there were a major land swap. The issue is this commission judging this offset provisions very well may not have control. And you may say, that's okay, we trust our sisters and brothers 20 years from now, or you may say, no, we understand this, and we're happy for there to be boundary modifications for all kinds of administrative things, but we don't want to see 30,000 acres pulled out here and put in there. That's the issue we're raising.
Right, okay. I thought we argued that we did trust our successors in this business, just on the other issues, right? That was your argument before, Ed, right? Well, I think we'll, unless you suggest otherwise, I'd let this recommendation go as it is and see what kind of, if others share our optimism about future LURC commissions. But I do think the idea of managing the boundaries as an administrative matter is probably an important one that we should be able to deal with in a straightforward, practical way.
Right.
Because obviously there probably will be boundary issues that need to be resolved. I think we've discussed the addition of lands to the Ballant easement in the development quite a bit in the development discussion we had yesterday.
This is the exact same issue.
It's the same issue. So, amendments to the easement. we had some discussion of that prior. Is there anything more you want to deal with here?
No. You know, I would note the last sentence under the concept plan proposal that one safeguard, and maybe a significant safeguard, is LURC must approve amendments. Mm-hmm. Having said that, will LURC be around 30 years from now, or 70 years from now, or 100 years from now? I don't think anyone is pressing enough to know the answer to that. As this is written, and I think it, just to emphasize, it very much cuts both ways in this dynamic versus static conundrum. The holder has broad discretion to accept amendments that involve uses or proposed improvements not contemplated by or addressed, so long as holder determines amendments are consistent with the purposes of this easement and does not materially increase adverse impact. So to the extent that you're comfortable with the holder authority, one can look at that language as being about as good a balance as you can get. And we're not suggesting, our recommendation here in the language, and it was quite intentional, that direct staff and legal counsel, because he's the one who's going to resolve this, that's why that was in there, to the commission to evaluate whether this degree of latitude to amend provisions is appropriate, as well as who should be allowed to approve it. This language may be right on the money, given what you're trying to balance, but Jerry's and my purpose in giving this a separate box, a separate table, is to draw your attention to this issue and to take any direction you may want to give us on this.
Well, I'm not sure we have any better look into the future than you do. But
I think we've talked about this.
All right, we'll just go back and look at this language again and come back to refinement if we think a refinement is appropriate.
Do you feel you lack guidance given our previous discussions in this area?
I think
at least in terms of the intent of the commission, guidance may be difficult to derive from any source to address this issue, but
I think the intent, if I may try to summarize what I've heard of the commission, is to preserve the integrity and the purpose of what you potentially are going to vote on, but not presume that you have omnipotence or prescience to eliminate potential uses that would not be inconsistent with those conservation values and what you're trying to achieve. And it may be that this wording right here is as good as anybody can get. There are other issues besides the standard itself, which is who decides. Right now, it's the holder, and LURC must approve. And again, that may be just right. So,
if you're comfortable, we can, at this point, Ed?
I think we've given about as much direction as we can get.
Can't get right. in that case, the assignment of holder rights to another holder.
This issue is quite a narrow one. Under the balance easement language, the grantor is required or is allowed, is given the authority to approve or not approve the transfer of the holdership from one holder to another. we're suggesting that that kind of right of rejection or refusal may not be appropriate. I think what could very well be appropriate is grantor consultation in that, hearing grantor objections to that. You know, you may have a situation where you have a particularly on top of it aggressive holder who, for reasons that I can't predict 50 years from now, wants to transfer to another holder, or a holder that's not being aggressive and the third party is insisting that it get transferred to a more aggressive or more on top of it holder. And I'm not sure ultimately the grantor should be able to deny that decision on who the holder should be. I think the grantor has a stake in commenting on it, and so that's really what we're saying.
Who is going to say that's okay to do that? Is that?
I think that's going to, a lot of this discussion is going to depend on who you decide the holder should be. For instance, if you have a nonprofit who's the holder and a state agency is the third party, you could do it as it's written now, which is the third party has to approve of the grant. So that if nonprofit X decides to give it to nonprofit Y, there has to be a showing of competence, a track record, experience, and third party approval with comment by the grantor and the ability to object and all those kinds of things. This is really quite a narrow point.
Okay.
So normally in a relationship where the development rights have been transferred out through a conservation easement, does the grantor generally have any further discussions with the holder of the easement?
As to who should be another holder?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you do see those provisions. I don't think this, I think it runs the gamut, but I'm not suggesting that this provision is inconsistent with other easements. I am suggesting, going back to one of the themes, that given the public rights here and the enforcement, that you may want to have a slightly different lens in looking at what otherwise is a fairly standard provision. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Okay. We can move on then. I guess looks like the final recommendation on the balance easement has to do with language, just giving the staff the ability to review all the language and making sure that it's consistent. I mean, this is consistent with several of the other recommendations, I think, at this point.
Yeah, this is a narrow point. I gave you an example where the management plan allows the holder and the landowner to agree to amendments. The easement requires the third party. There's an example I pulled out where in the second whereas clause, rare and exemplary natural communities are part of the conservation values, where they're referred to in paragraph 5C, Romanet 1, as unique natural areas. This is a complicated document that is going to live in perpetuity and which has both benefit and potentially suffered from many revisions over time to try to meet needs. And my experience in having put together those documents is often I come back to them a year later and I'm slightly embarrassed by that, not because I didn't try hard, but after a certain amount of time, you've burned out the neural framework that's looking at those words, and the neural framework has to be, you know. And I think that is what's going on here. So it's a narrow recommendation that if this other stuff, your recommendation is to just go back and really scrub this thing, because in perpetuity is a really long time.
Okay, I think we all agree with that. Yes. I could safely say. Are we going to wait a year to do it, Ron? Is that what you're saying?
No. I think this would be a direction that Jerry would jump into full force right away. My suggestion is that the weeks he has blocked out for his summer vacation would be the perfect time to rid himself of family distractions and get deeply involved in this drafting issue.
All right, we'll leave it at that then. Thank you, Ron. The conservation framework, I guess, involves the legacy easement, the roaches, and number five, bog. I think, just as preface this, I believe that many of the changes, the things we've discussed on the legacy easement also apply to the balance easement. The major policy issues associated with the language and all that sort of stuff, there were minor differences. I think, Gwen, you may have more questions about wind power, since the wind power is allowed in the balance easement, the legacy easement, the construction of the towers themselves, whereas the legacy easement simply was the supporting infrastructure. So I don't know if there's concerns in that regard.
Yeah, let me just clarify that. As the chair said, in the balance easement, roads, transmission lines to wind was allowed. In the legacy easement, as the chair said, the actual turbines or towers were allowed. I think that is more a reflection of where there may be viable wind resources, and that they exist in certain portions of the legacy easement, but not the balance easement. But in order to tie into the T&D system, et cetera, you'd have to pass through balance easement. Our recommendation is to eliminate that distinction and just say wind power and appurtenant activities are allowed, subject to no adverse impact on the conservation values. You know, and again, looking into the future, 40 years from now, you may have a new vertical wind turbine that doesn't operate that way, that operates that way, that can operate at very low wind speeds, that's a micro turbine, blah, 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 and that there's no inherent reason why it shouldn't be placed in the balance easement if it's not inconsistent with the conservation values. It's wireless. That's right.
It may not have the resource location limitations that current technology expresses. Mm.
Yeah. Well, okay, that being said...
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Yeah.
Again, as you mentioned earlier, that a lot of the discussion on the balance easement sort of osmosed or bled into the legacy easement. Would it be possible, rather than sort of go down through each one of these and suffer redundancies, not to give this discussion short shrift, but would it be useful or appropriate if you could highlight perhaps the areas of where there are unique issues raised in this section?
There are none that you haven't covered.
All right.
Our recommendation is that the only difference, other than what we've talked about already, between the balance and the legacy easement is that to the extent that there are certain construction materials, septic spreading, gross limits on how much can be done, that because of the scale of the legacy easement, that limitation may be either different in the legacy easement or maybe one lump sum number. But other than that...
Do you see any logic that would dictate two different numbers?
I see logic that would dictate a gross number and then kind of figure it out. But that might be a wording situation where Jerry looks at it 2 months from now on day two of his vacation and said, we need two separate numbers. But that's the only real difference other than what we've talked about.
So once again, it's up to Jerry.
That is my intent in the staff consultant recommendations, Mr. Commissioner.
I think we did discuss yesterday the idea of the fact that the legacy easement, as this is a sale, that sale had to close within a certain time frame that you specified here. Are you comfortable that?
Yeah, it's the same.
Is everybody
thing.
Here comfortable with that? That was disposed of.
Not only comfortable, but again, as we talked about yesterday, I think this is an integral part.
Right.
I do want to note this is not a difference between the two easements. In response to Commissioner Laverty's question, but this is a difference in what's been presented as funding. On page 100, the stewardship fund, Plum Creek proposed and FSM endorsed Plum Creek providing a monitoring stewardship fund for the balance easement. In questioning of TNC, when the commission asked what happens for the legacy easement, the response that's noted here in footnote 93 from TNC was that, what we stated, TNC stated in its agreement with Plum Creek at the time the purchase and sale agreement was executed was that TNC would be responsible for raising the funds needed for monitoring and stewardship. What we are saying in the recommendations is, using Evan's word from yesterday, the staff is agnostic as to where the money comes from. What we're strongly recommending to you is that through this process in the right-hand column, that a sufficient stewardship and monitoring fund, an enforcement fund, be developed for both easements and in place. But that's not a difference between them. No. It's just knitting them together.
Do you have any thoughts on the size of that fund?
Well, whatever my thoughts are, the record evidence is incomplete, which goes back to why this recommendation is what it is. We have record evidence that what's proposed by Plum Creek is sufficient and quite likely more than sufficient to cover the balance easement. We have Forest Society of Maine. We have record evidence from TNC that what's proposed they don't believe is sufficient for the entire legacy easement as it is. And overarching this is that the proposal as to what would constitute the stewardship fund, Commissioner White, the terms of it came in 2 hours before the testimony was supposed to start on that issue in January, and so there was not the what I think of as the normal process we established for the parties to see what the proposal was and therefore to be the full fall to comment on it. So, which, you know, I expressed at the time was frustrating. What we're recommending here is a process to kind of back up and figure that out.
Okay. I don't see anything else here that we haven't talked about, so that if you want to talk about the, I don't want to dismiss the legacy easement, it's the biggest one there is, so